Hi everyone, welcome to Octopod. My name is Allie and I am one of the hosts of this podcast along with the wonderful Ray and Nick. This podcast is produced by Octo, or Open Communications for the Ocean. Octo also produces newsletters, shares literature and news, runs listservs and more, all about the ocean, with the goal of connecting ocean professionals around the world and giving them the knowledge and networks they need to succeed. Each week, we will be sharing a little bit of the ocean news and scientific literature that has come to our attention in the past week, as well as any updates from Octo that can help you be more involved with ocean management and conservation. We are super excited to share what we have discovered each week with you ocean lovers. So without further ado, let's use a common ocean pun and dive right in. Hi everyone, Ray and I here today for your weekly Octopod. We have, again, a literature item and a news item to talk with you about, and I'm really excited to talk about this literature item because it's basically everything I'm interested in. So I'm going to dive right in because I've got a lot to say. So this paper was called, it's still around.
Whatever.
It's called Identifying Indicators of Aesthetics in the Great Barrier Reef for the Purposes of Management, and it was published in February of this year. And it's by a variety of authors, starting with Nadine Marshall, Paul Marshall, and Matt Koenig. And then there's also, I'll just say them all. There was also Bettina Pert, Adam Smith, and Bernard Vesperes. And it was published in Plus One. And you can find this at oct.to-pod68 or in our show notes. And I will say that link again after I talk about it. So basically, aesthetics are important, and while not all of you may agree with this, and you might live in a pretty dirty home or drab house and be just fine with that, I think that you can all agree that a more beautiful and aesthetically pleasing landscape will get more visitors, and that the beauty is the draw to those places. And those aesthetics are also often a major driver for those places to get made into protected areas. So think about Yosemite. If it wasn't so beautiful, would it be a protected area? Would so many people go? Because these beautiful landscapes provide us with a lot of things like well-being, recreation, and a sense of place, among others, they also provide us with money. Money. So beauty can translate into economic value, especially when visitors are coming to see and experience that beauty. So you're getting tourism. The Great Barrier Reef, which is the main case study for this paper that I'm talking about, has a total economic value of around $56 billion. And that actually contributes to the Australian GDP by, I believe it was $6 billion, something around there. This would not be the case if the place was ugly and gross. I mean, I think we can all agree on that. I think that just makes sense. Who's going to go visit somewhere and swim and look at reef in a place that's disgusting? Because aesthetics so strongly affects us and our economy, we can actually use aesthetic value in environmental management as a reason to support the protection of places and to maximize the contribution of that aesthetic value to us as a society. But currently, we don't use those aesthetic values much in our monitoring programs, and they aren't often in our management targets of protected places. So this makes it hard to track how well we are doing at keeping those aesthetic benefits around. So how well are we protecting these places for the reason we protected them for, which was the beauty? As the authors say, one of the main reasons aesthetic values aren't incorporated is probably because we don't quite have the tools to measure those values. So that's what the authors wanted to do. They wanted to see if they could define the indicators of aesthetic values, or basically measure what makes something aesthetically pleasing or not aesthetically pleasing, so that those values could be used to support management of the Great Barrier Reef specifically in this paper, but they want all coral reefs and everywhere, essentially. And the Great Barrier Reef isn't doing so hot, sadly, as I think most of you who listen to this probably know. But if you don't know, the Great Barrier Reef is sad. But monitoring it for decades, and it's just not doing so hot. So again, as you all probably know, the Great Barrier Reef is underwater. It is a reef. And there really hasn't been much research into aesthetic value underwater, probably because it's hard to get there. I mean, you have to scuba dive or snorkel and, you know, be underwater, and people don't go underwater that often. But there has been research on land on aesthetic values, which can probably be related to underwater. So I'm going to give a quick overview of the author's literature review on that land research. Basically, people like a few things. They like rare species. We like diversity. We like biodiversity. And we like complexity in our landscapes. We also like it when it looks like there is minimum human influence, which I think is kind of funny because if you're seeing it, you're hopefully there, or I guess you're looking at a picture. But getting deeper into kind of artsy language, we are also influenced by composition, balance, harmony, and color. And then getting into color more, color can either detract or add to our aesthetic appreciation. For example, we like colors that are associated with other things we like. So we like blue because we associate it with clear skies and clean water. And then the opposite's true. We don't love brown because we associate it with poop and rotten things. But if colors are perceived by us to be natural, we like them better. So even if like we see yellow water, but we think it's like supposed to be like that, we're gonna like it better. We're gonna think it's more aesthetically pleasing. We also like higher saturation and brightness in our colors. And all of that stuff relates to an aesthetic score. It's going to be hard for me to say this whole time. Aesthetic score.
Difficult
but
word.
That's not all. We also prefer the words, like if you think of the words openness, light, and a good view. So, I mean, if you can picture Yosemite or pictures you've seen of Yosemite, you can see its openness. It's open. It's got a lot of light and it's got a great view. Sound and smell are also something that affects aesthetics, as well as the sense of familiarity and a sense of novelty. So that's just kind of like a basic overview. From the little underwater aesthetic research that has happened, we know that shape is important in the influence of aesthetic value as well. And that kind of that relates to reefs, so the shape of our corals. And rocks, I guess. So there's like a lot of factors, as I just said, and there's not much help for environmental managers who want to keep track of the aesthetic conditions of where they're managing. So the trick is to find a way to measure aesthetics that's fairly objective, because everyone has slightly different personal aesthetic tastes. And there is research supporting that these differences in our aesthetics tastes might not actually be too big to negate using this aesthetic value for management. So the authors of this paper buckled down to search for reliable indicators of aesthetic value for the managers of coral reefs specifically. And they found a group of people who had a long-term relationship with the Great Barrier Reef. And these people were half female. They had a mean age of around 53 years old. And they were photographers, managers, reef experts and tourism people, as well as more. And these people were interviewed. And this is called a key informant study. And it was done in a semi-structured interview style for all of you interview nerds out there like me. And themes from these interviews were parsed out to get an initial list of potential aesthetic indicators. They narrowed these down into bins until they got a solid 12 themes to work with. And then they figured out 5 indicators from these, which were coral cover, coral pattern, coral topography, fish abundance, and visibility. Then they carefully picked out a big range of photos that represented these indicators in various ways, and they made individual ratings of each image against each indicator with a high, medium, or low score. Then finally, they went online and did a survey of over 1,400 random but representative Australians who each rated a selection of the images on a scale of attractiveness. Sorry, this is long. I just thought this paper was super interesting, so I have a lot to say about it. Of the 5 indicators that they did use in the online survey, the authors found that coral topography, fish abundance, and visibility were the ones that were significantly, in a statistical sense, correlated with the aesthetic ratings. And those 12 themes that they discovered in those key informant interviews that I mentioned earlier are also important, and those were, get ready for a list here, naturalness, composition, clear water, color, charisma, coral, experience, tiny things, I love that, healthy, aerial, recreation, and fish. with naturalness and clear water being mentioned most often. So this was a pilot study. So what we gained from this is the knowledge that there are factors that can be used to monitor aesthetics. Some might not be suitable for that task, but others are more objective and could be. There are also combinations of indicators where one can overwhelm another or combine to negate their influence, which just makes it a little bit more complicated. But overall in the study, they found that coral topography, fish abundance, and visibility were statistically reliable predictors of aesthetics, as in with more complex topography, more fish, and better visibility, meaning more attractive to us. Another important finding that was kind of mentioned in the paper is that demographics like age and education and whether or not these interviewees had been to the reef at all did not actually affect their judgment of aesthetics. They all had pretty much the same judgment. The one demographic that did, though, weirdly, was that females gave higher ratings overall. Like, I mean, I guess what I'm getting from the paper is that even the lower ones on the aesthetic scale, they rated higher than everyone else. And the authors just have no idea why that could be. I'm not sure. Maybe females see the glasses half full. I don't get it. But there is a ton further to go with this. This was a pilot study, and the authors describe what can happen next in their conclusion. But I will stop talking and hand it over to Ray.
Wow. That was a really interesting paper, actually. I love hearing about aesthetics and how people sort of perceive them individually. And this was sort of cool to see how on the mass people sort of perceive the coral reef and underwater, you know, subjects. My question, though, is, what is with the 12 themes that were listed, what is charisma? What does that mean?
You know, they described it in the paper, and I didn't like really focus on that, but hang on, I got this.
Okay.
So if you – oh, I see. Okay. So if you think of like charismatic animals,
yeah,
you think of like whales, turtles, dolphins, like bigger fish. So encounters with – here's what they say. This is a quote. Encounters with charismatic animals were described – as special interactions that were very much about the personal response to being in nature and interacting closely with wildlife. So if you have an experience with a charismatic, that's a critical part of the aesthetic appreciation of the Great Barrier Reef. So I'm guessing that the more emotions you get with if a charismatic animal is around, it's more beautiful. You interpret nature as more beautiful.
Okay.
So it's interesting. Yeah. And this was in the key informant interview, so they didn't necessarily have this in the images. But this is just what people were saying. They were like, I don't know. The GBR itself, I guess, the Great Barrier Reef itself, or GBR, is charismatic.
No, it absolutely is. I feel like, well, the GBR itself in its entirety is sort of like one giant charismatic organism, which I think is really cool. Because everything in there lives off each other.
Yeah. I loved the tiny things one.
I know. I was going to say, yeah, that. Yeah.
We just love tiny things.
I mean, it's true. People just love tiny objects.
So much. Aww. Oh, I found this that totally off topic, but I found this tiny little plant pot, like one of those little orange ones. And it's literally the size of my, like half of my thumb. Aww. And I love it so much.
I used to collect
tiny things.
Oh, no. I just used to collect tiny little things. Don't worry about it.
Same. So you can actually see the top image is and the lowest images in aesthetic score in the paper, which is open access. And again, you can find this paper at – see, now I closed my thing, so I don't know.
Oh, there it is. Pod 68.
Pod 68. So oct.to-pod68, or look in the show notes. And again, super interesting paper. I loved it. Great job, authors.
Woo. Thank you, authors. And thank you for posting open access. Yay.
Woo-hoo.
All right. Well, I'm going to switch notes a little bit here, and I'm going to talk to you guys about some news. So this article is from The National, and it is an opinion piece written by Johan Bergenes and Monica Medina. It is titled The 5 Pernicious Myths About Seafood. So the authors dive into some hard truths about the fishing industry. Some most of you will know, and some you may not. The authors set out to discuss 5 commonly held myths about the global fishing industry. And I'm going to go through all the different 5 ones that they described. So the first one is illegal fishing is only an environmental issue. That's the myth. Illegal fishing not only harms the environment by either fishing in protected areas or by removing fish at an unsustainable rate, but it's also incredibly harmful to people. And so that myth is false. These people are also affected by illegal fishing. In certain countries, Indonesia and Argentina are just two examples. They've in the past and currently have used violence against IUU fishers. And this actually really reminds me of a recent bombshell expose by BuzzFeed on how the World Wildlife Fund is basically paying for paramilitary troops to take out would-be poachers. And so illegal fishing is not just about the fish and the environment. It is also about how we react to the illegal fishers. And is our reaction too much? What reaction is proper sort of in there? But no, we need to not just take in how much people are taking out, we need to take in why and understand more behind the people's aspect of what they're doing. The second myth is that the fish you buy is the fish you get. So in 2016, Oceana released a report detailing global fish fraud, and they actually came out with a similar report this week, but just focusing on the U.S. In the 2016 report, out of 25,000 fish samples taken from restaurants and stores, they found that 1 in 5 were mislabeled with the wrong fish. That's kind of incredibly frightening. So you think you go out, you plan what you're going to get with your fish, you research what's good, what's bad, you know, you have your little, whatever that one aquarium is that does like the little tracking of fish.
Seafood watch,
thank you. You know what you're going to do. And then you realize later on that you were lied to. I mean, how terrible is that? And in a similar structure, the fish you eat, you believe, this is the myth, that the fish you eat is fresh and wild. So customers tend to believe the labels they see. So you see that it's labeled a certain fish, you'll believe that. You also see that it's fresh, freshly caught. But that has been found to be wrong. I mean, 50% of fish sold at stores come from aquaculture, but we rarely see that on the label. And fresh is sort of, they don't really say what the definition of freshness is, because even if the fish were caught wildly, boats can hold fish in their storage containers for up to 24 months. So that's 2 years that they can be held there, which not necessarily, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because the longer you hold fish in deep freeze, the less likely them to be ridden with any sort of parasites. But it's mostly just the honesty behind it, right?
That kind of feels weird. I don't know. That just feels weird to me.
Right?
You're eating a two-year-old dead fish.
Right. I know that sort of weirded me out today, because it's been in storage for 2 years.
I guess I can keep things in my freezer for longer.
I know. At least it has to be like deep frozen. I don't really know. I want to go into some of those storage containers on a boat one day and like see how they do it.
Yeah,
because that's pretty wild that they can hold them for so long.
Right.
The fourth myth is that seafood is not wasted. By a report by UNFAO found that 35% of fish catches are discarded. I don't know, and they didn't really describe it in the article itself, if this includes bycatch. They mentioned bycatch, but even so, that is an unreasonably high number, to me at least. And the last myth is that fishing is a highly profitable business. And that used to be true, you know, in the 1800s, early 1900s, fishing used to be very profitable when stocks were abundant and restrictions were low. Now, with 90% of global fishing stocks facing depletion, and with the onslaught of necessary strict regulations, fisheries are not so profitable. America and other major fishing countries all provide subsidies for their fishing sectors. There's also the issue of forced labor in fisheries, which we are seeing is far too common. The solutions our authors present is increased fishing vessel tracking data to these five myths, so we know what the vessels are and where they are, when they're there, and what they're catching, as well as increasing accountability within each of the fishing organizations and communities. For the tracking, at least, there are groups working on that. One in particular is the Global Fishing Watch, which tracks and shares data about fishing activities worldwide, and it tracks data by the moment, and it's free for users. You can just go onto their website and see what fishing vessels are out there and what they're catching and how much. I don't know how much, but you can at least see the vessels out there. If you want to go see what they're doing, you can just search for Global Fishing Watch, and it will just take you to the website. But I thought this was a really interesting paper, and they brought up some really interesting points to think about.
That is super interesting. I mean, I feel like I was falling for some of these myths.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I I've been hearing about how, like, when you go to a store or a restaurant, you might not be getting the right the fish species that you were asking for. And I mean, that's so hard to tell because you're not generally just buying a whole fish with a head on, at least in the US and in some grocery stores. But super interesting. That sounds like a great paper.
Yes. I implore you to read it. Well, you can find it at articles. Yeah, not paper. Sorry, I said paper. Article, and it's at oct.to/pod69.
Perfect. Well, I think that's all for today. We don't want to keep you much longer. This is one of our longer episodes because I kept talking.
It's a great paper, though. Don't yeah.
So we will see you all next week, and thank you for listening. Right, bye.
Thank you, listeners. Bye.
To dive deeper into the content we talked about this week, check out the episode notes or go to octogroup.org, where you can find a link for this podcast. Thank you all for listening in. Please rate us on iTunes or wherever you are listening and give us a shout with any feedback you have. We would love to hear from you.